there have been individual imaginations, and there have also been collective imaginations. A nation may have one imagination distributed through all its members. We have seen things like that in war, where nations go and decimate themselves to fulfill an imaginary victory, where no victory is actually possible. The wise may know that no nation ever won a war, but ignorance will always keep on trying to. And this is the problem of magic. White magic is therefore, properly termed, the dedication of all of the assets of the individual to the achievement of the greatest good. Incidentally, this dedication guarantees the proper use of these faculties and protects the individual from the results of his own mistakes. An individual who keeps rules will be punished in some way, even if he didn't know better. He will not be punished as he would if he did know better, but he will still have to be disciplined in order to get over ignorance. But if he intentionally and knowingly, and not from ignorance, commits a crime against society, he has to pay for it. In the little flowers that float around under the trees with the serpents twisted around them, we have something that's interesting and comes up in Asia, and that is the Western paradise of Amitabha, the paradise of the reincarnationist, the paradise of the individual who doesn't believe in anything being forever, but is a reward and a passing. A paradise of Amitabha, it is a large sense of the word, is a vacation. It is an interlude. It is an opportunity for the individual to experience the benefits of his own achievements. But they had to be achievements that had within them no selfishness, no injury of another person, no breaking of rules, no exploitation of natural resources. In order to be equipped to receive the peace of natural law, it must be kept. Those who break it break the peace. And in the paradise of Amitabha, the souls are born out of lotus buds in the lotus lake, and all wake and adoring the principle of eternal truth. There are no houses there, although Andrew Jackson Davis thought some people might have a few estates over on the other side. He wasn't very sure of it. I think Emanuel Swedenborg was more sure of it, but he's been passed over rather likely also. But the real fact of the matter is that the paradise of Amitabha is simply a natural state in which there is no conflict within the individual. And pain goes to sleep because there is nothing to keep it awake. Vice goes into darkness and vanishes because there is no one to go with it. Everything that causes inharmony individually, worldwide, cosmically, is to do with the struggle to understand and apply the principles that belong to these different worlds. Now, in the initiation rites, the candidate to the first degree took dominion over certain phases of nature. He didn't take over the phases being able to govern nature or to exploit it or to pervert it or to sublease it, but rather to obey it. From the beginning to the end, there is a law. This law is greater than anyone can ever know. That is the one thing we know and dares to break. At the moment we break the universal edict of the purpose for existence and the destiny for which we were intended, we are cast out. Cast out doesn't mean that we're damned. It doesn't mean that we have to go to Hades. Cast out means that we've been set outside until we learn better, and then we let us in again. We just have to realize that the moment we break the great rules, we lose the benefits of growth. We lose the peace of mind. We lose the happy home. We lose the cheerful children. We lose and the good health. We lose everything when we break the rules. So in the ancient times, there were three steps. The human being was 9 months in the womb, and three steps made 12, and that was the zodiac, and that was the perfect circle. So 9 months in the womb, and the 3 degrees of the mysteries. constituted the enlightened human being. And the three degrees of the mysteries had to do with that broken circle which exists between Christmas and Easter in the Christian rite. It is the wheel of broken spokes in the canonization of Hypatia of Alexandria. All of these symbols represent, therefore, that we take 9 months in the womb and 3 degrees of conscious growth to complete the embodiment of the individual. Only when both of these are present, these two factors, is the person truly born. He is born imperfect. He is given the right to perfection. And he is given the eternal textbook, as the alchemist said. The deity has given man the great textbook, nature. But he must learn to read it by walking it with his feet. He cannot learn it simply by reading about it and forgetting it. He cannot gain from the story of wars unless he realizes their futility. He cannot gain knowledge of the collapse of stock exchanges and what they mean until he realizes that the thing that brings them down is always lack of integrity. So the 3 degrees of the mysteries contribute integrity. And when integrity is contributed to the 9 steps, then the individual at this stage becomes completely balanced in the mystery of emotion. The emotional nature, the astral light, becomes properly balanced when he has achieved the idea that emotion, the great emotion, is affection. And a great affection is that which does not worship anything, but is the affection for all that lives. As long as the individual has a man or woman whom they do not like, that affection is not complete. Anyone who belongs to a religion and don't like another religion, that person's affections are not complete. The one who will take care of one of his own and neglect the stranger, his affections are not complete. Complete affection is the individual recognizing the unity of all that lives, and that is the proper opportunity of the wise to serve those in need of wisdom. It is the opportunity of the wise to instruct, and the opportunity of the young to receive instruction. All these things are part of a system that goes back to the dawn of time, a system we will never be able to probably understand where it originated, but we know that it has been with us for thousands of years. Now, to get back to this emotional problem, which is particularly for us today, we also realize that emotion is definitely a rate of vibration. Not only is it a rate of vibration, but it is a major weight of vibration which breaks down into an octave. The emotional octave consists of the 7 levels of emotion, just as the 7 orders of architecture constitute the mystery of the building craft. We know that the emotional octave goes through the same septenary as that of the incarnating life, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, human, and finally into what the Buddhists call the Buddhic level. This is the level that of the stone in the handle of the sword of Paracelsus. Azoth. Azoth is the symbol of the stone. And the symbol of the stone is the transmutation of the base elements until perfection is achieved. And in the human being in the East, this is called Bodhi or Buddha, the sign of achievement, the sign of the complete renunciation of error or of illusion. And in the West, it is carried by the messiahs, the great sages and world teachers. But it always is the same. Emotion must be changed. It must be universalized. It must be redeemed in all its states, or it cannot become the basis or the handmaiden of wisdom. It cannot lead to the true wisdom of things unless its own inadequacies have been redeemed. We can say to ourselves, how can you be wise if you are still selfish? You can't be. Therefore, if you want to be wise, selfishness must go first. There's no other way it can go. You can't say that mind goes first and leaves emotions. It has to be this upward motion, this upward movement. So wherever there is a victory of reality over an illusion, one of the little poison flowers is relieved of the serpent. It has to go this way. And only when a certain percentage of our attitudes and ideals have reached this maturity are we able to move then into the higher level, which would be the mental atmosphere. It was only then that maybe we would complete the purpose of our present evolutionary cycle, which consists of the four levels which we must pass through in order to attain to Bodhi, or the symbol of cosmic mind. Now, cosmic mind really has nothing to do with intellect, and here we've gone into another problem that is always with us and will always be. Namely, that words will not explain matters properly. And every religion has names for every one of the spiritual realities of life. It has names for the soul, for the mind, for the heart. It has all the metaphysics and ethics of all other religions, but different words for them. And we have now fallen into the habit of figuring that the words were the most important, that individuals who used different words had different beliefs. This is simply not true. It is the fact that a belief separated from their sources for a long time and given into the keeping of the underprivileged and the unworthy have gradually lost their meaning. We no longer use them correctly. We no longer know what they mean. And because we find different words in different religions, we believe these different religions are different. This is not true. Every religion in the world has been struggling to find the correct way of explaining the path of growth. It will always have difficulties because it will have different words to overcome. The various people who go to one path after another are seeking not the path, but a familiar term that they can immediately accept. If they do not find this, they think the religion is wrong. So in this dual growth that we're talking about, in the emotional world, we have all different levels and different names for them, different words to represent, sometimes desire, sometimes emotion, sometimes the astral light, many different terms, but they're all terms for one principle. An individual who understands one of the terms understands all of them, but may not, because of mental blockage, be willing to relinquish one for another. He must keep on believing exactly as he did, and those who do not use the same words are heretics. This has done a great deal to divide faiths and to prevent the unity of religions. Having decided in their minds, at least, that we have to master this emotional factor, there are ways in which we can go to work studying it. There are many different ways we can consider its importance. One of these is that a correct emotion will never hurt us. Now, people have fear, they have sorrow, they have unhappiness of one kind or another. They have mental pain, emotional pain, and physical pain. Therefore, there are hurts. But if the emotional nature is mature, the damage caused by emotion upon the other compound of the body will not cause sickness, will not cause evil, will not result in the loss of integrities. In other words, if you are basically right, affliction will not force you to become wrong. You may decide that it looks easier, but if you do, you're mistaken. Actually, the answer to all questing is peace. And peace is very hard to come by. And no one is going to be perfect at it. But peace can come in certain areas with everyone. They had an old grudge. Peace will be increased and health will be enlarged if in one way or another they correct that grudge, get over it. Sometimes the persons against whom we have grudges will not accept our apology. They will continue to dislike it. But our first moral duty is to make the effort. Let it die within us as no longer any hurt or antagonism. Invite the friendship. If it is given, wonderful. If it is not, consider that there is no longer any grief or any grievance between you and that other person. All the way along, therefore, correct wherever emotional stress obviously reacts against the body's health below and the mental integrity above. If we can solve that problem, we could have a much happier and healthier existence. We must all have some problems we're not going to face correctly right now, but we can also grow. And today we are all very health conscious. We want to be healthy. We want to try to avoid as far as we can the mistakes that are being displayed for us every day in the newspapers. We want to get over alcohol and heavy use of tobacco and all these things. They tell us frankly that if we don't get over them, they will ultimately destroy us. Now, what we do not realize that a grudge is just as poisonous as nicotine, that a hate is just as dangerous to our material security as narcotics, because both the hate and the fear or the grudge are all illusions. There is no such a thing as a bad reality. All realities are good, and what appear to be real but are not good are illusions. We live in a world of illusions which we use to build or protect our own dispositions. We do not want to accept our deficiencies. We do not want to be convicted of them. We hope that we can hide them from everybody except ourselves. But the only thing that would do any good would be to hide them from ourselves, and this is impossible. So that there is nothing to be done by catering to any illusion. Nature has set us this example. Nearly every problem we have in society today is marked to be an illusion. Well, why is it an illusion? How can we say that? It is an illusion because it lacks reality. And what is reality? Reality is permanence. Reality never changes. Reality never hurts. It is never less. And it is all, and therefore it cannot become more. Therefore, anything that gives us a few years of pleasure and then is buried with us, so our ancestors left it to us and our descendants take it from us, that's all illusion. Wealth is illusion. Power is illusion. Success is largely illusion. The only parts of man's effort to grow that are real are the parts which make him a better person, make him kinder and richer in understanding, be more able to accept beauty and to live constantly at peace with the sphere of his own existence. Actually, there's nothing that can be more beautiful for the individual than a fully matured emotional life. It is a magnificent thing. It opens the doors to all intimacies and relationships on the highest possible levels of integrity. It lifts love above all limitations of mortal mind. It lifts all of these emotions. It lifts beauty above all of the temptations of corrupted art. It lifts music out of the unpleasantness of the time being to the glory of the great sonata or the great oratorio. All these things, beauty of everything, can be cultured from a mature emotion, which gives us the realization and recognition of the essential values of life. Therefore, beauty is an emotional virtue. And virtue is to see the beauty that is hidden and bring it forth. And also to do all the things that we do as an artistic achievement. Great art is kindness and courtesy. Great art is forgiveness. It is also the individual living in an atmosphere of peace and surrounding himself as far as possible with the symbols of peace, beauty, live art, music, and the things that are real. The moment these are corrupted, the individual falls back again into the lower brackets of the animal kingdom and stays there till he redeems himself. Everything that is below the level of personal integrity is a relapse into a previous state which theoretically we should have outgrown. We can keep of this, thinking about this all the time, maybe a way of growing a little more successfully. We certainly hope it can be. So we have this ladder. Next lecture will be devoted to the next rung of this ladder. And the next rung of this ladder is the mind. Now, the mind is the most difficult of all of our perceptions and functions to understand. Mind is something that we very often mistake for ourselves. Mind is no longer merely my mind. It is I mind. If the individual says, when I speak my mind, I really said it. When in reality, when he speaks his mind, he's probably said nothing. Because the mind is not the source. All of these faculties are servants. The emotions are servants. The mind is a servant. Growth is a servant process. Mineralization is a servant process. Everything that we do and know is a form of service. The mind itself is not the ruler of life. It is not even the ruler of conduct. It is usually something we have to send to school and fight with it for the rest of our lives. So it becomes interesting, important, and valuable to give a little consideration to the ascent from the balance of the emotional nature to the balance of the mental powers and faculties. And here we come into the world of philosophy. Now, philosophy isn't the answer to anything in itself. Philosophy is only a degree of insight to help us to get nearer to the real. Every faculty we have, every part of ourselves, is important. By our feet, we can get physically nearer to where we want to go. By the various growth functions within ourselves, we can unfold faculties and powers to gain education or to travel from one place to another. By our emotions, we can enrich ourselves in the arts and in all of the more noble aspirations of human nature and lay a foundation in religion, which is of the greatest importance. Then by the mind, we come into the possession of science. We become part of the great scientific process, which at the present time is one of the most costly and dangerous processes known to man. We have not known the mind. We do not use the mind. The mind is a servant of the good in ourselves. The mind is an instrument for the manifestation of that which is behind, beyond, and above the mind. But to us, the mind becomes the glorious source of the fulfillment of all of the appetites which are satisfied by wealth and power. Thus, we have this problem to consider constantly. So next week, we ought to take up a study of the mind and see if we can find out a little more about it, what it stands for, and how we can use it. We must recognize that it is our moral duty to redeem and reform and resurrect all of the forces that have been put into our own composition. We must redeem our own emotions. They cannot redeem us. We must redeem the mistakes of our education. We must redeem whatever has been our fault of our heredity. We must redeem all aspects of ignorance in ourselves. We cannot do it all at once. But the wonderful mystery of it all is that the very act of redemption in itself is a beautiful necessity. It is something that the very moment we start with it becomes the most wonderful experience of all. So the process of correcting our own faults is not a laborious process, but a glorious one, leading in the end to all the good we hope for. That's it.